Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today on this Thanksgiving holiday, we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. As Americans sit down to their traditional Thanksgiving meal, we'll begin with the working poor who comprise most of the people on food stamps, and they have just had their meager allotment cut by the Republican Congress. So we'll look into the issues of hunger, food policy, and the growing ranks of the working poor who do not make a living wage and have to depend on food stamps and food banks. Rebecca Smith, the Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project, joins us to discuss the two biggest employers of the working poor, McDonald's and Walmart, who are attracting protests on this Thanksgiving and the following day of frenzied consumption known as Black Friday. Then we will speak with Lucio Guerrero, the Vice President of Communications for Feeding America, the nation's leading hunger relief organization and fourth largest charity. We will discuss the growing demand at food banks since the recent cut, with more to come in food stamps, and the work that Feeding America does in feeding 37 million Americans each year, including 14 million children and 3 million seniors. Then finally, we'll speak with Josh Sewell, the senior policy analyst at Taxpayers for Common Sense, about the nation's agriculture policy that has Congress increasing subsidies for agribusiness while cutting food stamps for the poor and hungry. Since corn was a gift from the Native Americans to the Pilgrims on that first Thanksgiving, we will look into how much our agriculture has been distorted since then, with 60% of crop insurance going to growing corn, making this now largely inedible crop the largest recipient of farm subsidies at a cost to taxpayers of $85 billion in less than 20 years. And joining us now is Rebecca Smith, who's the Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project, where she focuses on international human and labor rights, immigrants and work, enforcement of workplace standards, and unemployment insurance. She has testified before Congress and several state legislatures on these issues and has an article at the Huffington Post, Working Poor This Thanksgiving. Welcome to Background Briefing on this Thanksgiving, Rebecca Smith.
Thank you very much, Ian. I'm very happy to be here.
And this, is, of course, is an embarrassment, really, to think of how on this day when people are feasting and being joined by family, and it is truly one of the, I think, the nicest American rituals, and it so far has not been commercialized. However, what you're pointing out in your Huffington Post article is that there's an awful lot of people who make up the working poor who simply cannot afford to have the ritual Thanksgiving meal.
Yeah, Thanksgiving is really my favorite holiday, and it is a time when we sit down with our family and enjoy our friends and have a really nice meal together. And this year, that ritual has really been turned into another shopping day. And I guess what is most concerning to me is the impact on the workers at Walmart and other stores who aren't able to spend Thanksgiving at home with their family and instead are stocking shelves and working the cash register.
And, of course, the Black Friday, the day after, is already being advertised, and that is in stark contrast to the sort of family values of the day before Thanksgiving. The day after, you know, people go crazy and step over each other, right? It's not exactly an attractive sight, is it?
No, it isn't. And this year we have Walmart really deciding to get a jump on that view of our country on Black Friday by making a treasured holiday into Black Thursday for a lot of its employees and sending them off to work.
So how many people in this country are working poor in the sense that, you know, we have, well, first of all, we have 50 million Americans who go hungry each year, and that more than one in five of them are children. But you also have these low-wage workers who are both at Walmart, which is one of the richest companies on the planet, and one of the most startling and disgusting statistics that I've heard is that the Walton family, the heirs to the founder of Walmart, his children, their collective wealth is the equivalent of the combined wealth of 40% of the lower end of Americans. So that is just breathtaking when you think about it.
It is stunning. Walmart's CEO got a compensation package last year that was over $28 million. And you can look at that in one or two ways or more. He earned more than 1,000 of Walmart workers. He earns more in an hour than workers at Walmart earn in a year.
And why is it that they resist giving their workers a living wage? And they are very cynical. I don't know whether you've seen their latest advertising campaigns, but they have their workers. They don't even call them employees. They call them associates. And they're having these people appear in television ads as though they're not bordering on starvation, that they're somehow enjoying the fruits of the American dream, when it's just absolutely not true.
Well, I think one of the most poignant examples was the news that broke a couple of weeks ago now that a store manager in Ohio, in a Walmart in Ohio, put out a food collection box in his store. And, of course, this is also a tradition for Americans this time of year when we collect food and other items for folks who don't have the same luxuries as many of us. But the twist there was that the food collection box was not put out for the hungry and the homeless in that community. It was put out for Walmart's own employees who apparently were going hungry themselves on these holidays.
And again, I'm speaking with Rebecca Smith, who's the Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project, where she focuses on international human and labor rights, immigrants and work, enforcement of workplace standards, and unemployment insurance. She has testified before Congress and several state legislatures on these issues and has an article at the Huffington Post, Working Poor This Thanksgiving. But, I mean, the point is here, Rebecca, that we all have a stake in the fact that Walmart does not pay its workers a living wage because they then depend upon public assistance to the tune of about $4 billion annually. And then the second biggest low-wage employer in this country, McDonald's, they base – I don't know what their – I think their public assistance, yeah, their public assistance bill to the citizen and taxpayer is $1.2 billion each year. I mean, presumably these corporate executives who are getting these huge compensation packages that run Walmart and McDonald's, they must know that, I mean, in spite of their touchy-feely ads about how wonderful it is to work for Walmart, they must know this reality. Is this just pure cynicism on their part, or is there – I mean, I know a lot. There are a number of demonstrations planned for Black Thursday and Black Friday at Walmart. But how do you shame these people into doing the right thing?
Well, it's at best a huge disconnect. These CEOs have no inkling what it's like to try to live on the wages that they pay. And I think it does betray some cynicism when they are content to have their employees rely on generosity from coworkers and benefits that the public is paying for just in order to get by and to not be hungry and to have health care.
So why then do people shop at Walmart? I mean, obviously it's because the stuff is cheap or cheaper, but is there any way to make that connection between the fact that you're actually contributing to the poverty of your fellow citizens by shopping there? I mean, my sense, for example, on the political left in this country, most people really don't like what the Koch brothers stand for.
Mm-hmm.
And they are actively involved in trying to buy our politics and move our country to the right, which they've done very successfully. But yet people buy brawny paper towels and Dixie cups, and I just don't understand why it is that we aren't more focused on some kind of consumer boycott. Because if you can't shame these people, that these CEOs, into doing the right thing, then maybe if you affect their bottom line, they'll wake up and do the right thing, not for the right reason, but, you know.
I think at least a couple of things are going on. You mentioned the Walmart advertisements. I think a lot of Americans are taken in by those advertisements, and that's what they see as Walmart. They don't know these horrific statistics on what Walmart workers are earning and how much they are depending on the public to make ends meet in their household. And I think the other thing is that we are becoming a nation more and more of low-wage workers, and so that people see that if this is a place to shop, this is where I can actually afford something for my family. But I also think that more and more people are seeing the huge rise in inequality that we're seeing in this country, and they are starting to react and respond in really important ways. We see workers all around the country going out on one-day strikes. The fast food workers last week, port truck drivers in L.A. were out on strike. We see the Walmart workers, warehouse workers, really calling the public's attention to inequality in this country. And I think thanks to the fast food strikes, starting a conversation among the general public about how wrong this is and how it violates our basic values of equality in this country.
Well, we've already seen, Rebecca Smith, an incredible mean-spiritedness coming from a lot of the Republicans in Congress, particularly the Tea Party types, who have been forcing these cuts in the SNAP program, the food stamp program. And one of them, of course, is a recipient of enormous farm subsidies, this Tennessee Congressman, Stephen Fincher. And he even quotes the Bible in castigating the poor as though they don't work. The point here, and the point of the work that you've done and your article in the Huffington Post, is that these people have jobs. You know, they just don't make enough money. It's not as if they're lazy and they're sponging off their industrious fellow citizens. They're working incredibly hard. It's just that these employers are not paying them a living wage while they're paying themselves vast executive compensations.
Yeah, it's really a false narrative that's been created by the right. You've heard this all about makers and takers. Really, workers are the makers, and when you look at the number, the amount of money that just Walmart and McDonald's relies on from the public to feed and provide health care for their own employees, that becomes really clear. Workers are the makers, and these corporations are the takers. I think the other piece that people are starting to see is this piece about workers working extremely hard but just not able to make ends meet because of the wages that are paid. Jobs in retail and fast food are among the fastest growing jobs that our economy is creating, and 88% of workers who earn less than $10 an hour are adults. These aren't kids that are working in these jobs as some sort of entree to a career. These are career jobs, and we need to care about that, and we need to ensure that the jobs that our economy is creating are good jobs.
But if you factor in the fact that if these executives at Walmart and McDonald's had got less compensation or compensation more in line with most other industrial countries, you know, in Germany, you know, half the members of the boards of directors are unions, so that has an effect on lowering or reducing the wage disparity. In Japan, it's just culturally not acceptable for people to be obscenely overcompensated compared to those workers on the shop floor. Here, we seem to have absolutely no regard for economic fairness. But when you combine the fact that even if these executives kick back a little of their salary to their employees, everybody would be better off. You wouldn't have hungry people showing up to work all day long and have to, you know, rely on handouts. But then the profits go to this family who, as I pointed out earlier, combined, the heirs to Sam Walton, their combined wealth is the equivalent of the entire wealth of the lower 40% of all Americans. So, I mean, surely they could afford to kick back a little bit. How many more executive jets can you own? I mean, what the hell do they do with all that money? There's only, what, four or five of them?
There's a point at which would be impossible in several lifetimes to spend the amount of money that some of these folks are earning. And as you point out, in the case of Walmart, it's one family that's earning that amount of money. And for many corporations, there's really, there's not a rule that says that you have to make a certain amount of profits every year. Employers and these big corporations in particular could trim their profit margins. They could do a number of things that would mean that we wouldn't see these huge gaps between what an average worker earns and what a CEO earns. A lot of people like to talk about Henry Ford in this, when we're talking about equality at the workforce. The corporate culture has changed so much since the days of Henry Ford, who was, of course, no great advocate for workers' rights. But Ford wanted his employees to make enough money that they could actually afford to buy his cars. And that kind of corporate conscience, if you will, has really disappeared in the last several decades as we've seen corporations simply be motivated by profit.
So just in the last minute or so then, Rebecca Smith, what do you think will change our attitudes culturally to make this kind of greed unacceptable and to demand? I mean, for example, in the state of California, they passed legislation to raise the minimum wage to, I think, $10 an hour, which is still pretty low. Federally, it's just obscenely low. What, $7.75 or something ridiculous?
It hasn't been raised since 2007.
Right.
It's $7.25.
So tell me.
The federal minimum wage for tipped workers is a scandalous $2.15 per hour. $2.13.
So you couldn't even afford the bus fare to get to work, right?
That's right.
So what will it take culturally? Because, we're always told about how great this country is, the greatest on earth, has the best healthcare, the best this, the best the everything, and all that stuff is just, this conversation and the facts that we're talking about just absolutely make a mockery of all of that stuff. So at some point or other, I know, it's not considered patriotic to complain, but this has reached a point of obscenity. So what's it going to take?
Well, I think some of what it's going to take is already happening. As I've said, we've seen a huge increase in low-wage worker activism, activism and direct action strikes from low-wage workers themselves. But I think we're seeing kind of more and more ordinary people saying enough is enough. At the last election, little town in my home state of Washington, SeaTac, where the SeaTac airport is located, voters voted in a $15 an hour minimum wage. We have similar higher minimum wages in airports around the country from Miami to St. Louis. And I think when you ask regular people what is a fair wage, they will tell you something much higher than what is the current federal minimum wage, certainly, but even higher than what are some of the higher state minimum wages like California's and Washington State's.
Well, Rebecca Smith, I thank you so much for joining us here on Thanksgiving to talk about the extent to which our fellow citizens are being denied a living wage and are not enjoying the fruits of this holiday, which, again, is perhaps the nicest tradition that we have, but we simply can't be enjoying our turkey and stuffings and all of the fun and fellowship of family without at least, paying some attention to this terrible disparity in wealth and opportunity.
That's right. Happy Thanksgiving to you, and hopefully that workers all around are having a happier Thanksgiving than those who are working at Walmart today.
Again, I've been speaking with Rebecca Smith, who's the Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project, where she focuses on international human rights and labor rights, immigrants and work, enforcement of workplace standards, and unemployment insurance. She has testified before Congress and several state legislatures on these issues and has an article at the Huffington Post, Working Poor This Thanksgiving. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the growing demand at food banks since the recent cuts in food stamps. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lucio Guerrero, who is the Vice President of Communications for Feeding America, the nation's leading hunger relief organization and the country's fourth largest charity. As the nation's leading domestic hunger relief charity, Feeding America helps supply food to more than 37 million people each year, including 14 million children and 3 million seniors, through a network of 203 member food banks that are supported by 61,000 local community agencies across the country. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lucio Guerrero.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And on this Thanksgiving, it is something of an obscenity, I think, that as people sit down for their Thanksgiving meals and celebrate their families with all of the wonderful turkey and trimmings and dishes, and people, relatives are always bringing dishes in. And so, as you know, and as our listeners know, it's a wonderful feast. But sure. 50 million Americans go hungry every day in this country, and more than one in five of them are children. So what's going to happen to those people today? What's happening with those people today?
You know, they continue to struggle. So while for the vast majority of us and your listeners, they think that, you know, hunger doesn't exist around them, they're mistaken. Like you said, there's 50 million Americans who struggle with hunger, and that's, you know, that's everywhere. That's urban, that's rural, that's suburban, that's everywhere. There's no one part of the country that's immune to hunger. And so while, you know, we sit down for our Thanksgiving dinners, there's going to be those people out there in the land of plenty that don't have enough to eat or just can't make ends meet even when they're working.
And most of the people on food stamps are working.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's a misconception. A lot of people think that these are folks who are either homeless or don't have jobs. And no, most people on food stamps are working, or they have a senior in the home, or they have somebody who's disabled in the home who from a situation outside of one they can control, are in a situation where they can't make ends meet. And so what people don't realize is that a lot of these folks are not looking to become dependent on food stamps like some people accuse them of being. It's they're trying to make ends meet in a time, in a difficult time in their lives, and hopefully get back on their feet and then be able to get off the program. But, you know, with the situation the way it is out there, with the economy having, you know, a bit of a breakthrough for some folks, it hasn't trickled down to the most needy in our country, and those are the folks who are still struggling today. And, you know, Ian, as you probably know, you know, we've just are coming off of a cut to SNAP benefits for 47 million people, where they'll have even less to deal with this holiday season.
Well, I was about to bring that up, Lucio. You know, in the face of all of this, what is the Congress doing? They're cutting food stamps. And even the Democratic bill in the Senate calls for a cut as well. And by the way, the cuts that went in a few weeks ago, they're worse ones to come, are they not?
Yeah, so the ones that Congress has already done, that when the stimulus benefits expired in November 1st, those were cuts that 47 million people, everybody on food stamps across the board, doesn't matter if you're a senior, disabled, able-bodied, your food stamps were cut. And as we know, for most people, their food stamp benefits don't last a whole month to begin with. So now you're talking about, for a family of four, it could be about $36 a month, which, you know, for some families, it could be a whole week's worth of groceries where they won't have enough food to eat. Thankfully, there are organizations like ours, Feeding America, like our food banks, like our partner agencies, where we can help fill that void by supplying food to people when they need it. And as you know and you've seen, you know, our food banks can't do it alone. We can't do it alone. And so it really takes communal effort to try to make sure that our neighbors are fed.
So why do you think Fox News, for example, has been pushing this story for months now that some surfer out in California was buying crab, and, you know, as though all of these people, these 47 million people have just taken a hit, are a bunch of freeloaders?
Yeah, no, I think it's lobster is what we've been hearing. The reports is the surfer that buys lobster and crab. And if you look at the comment boards, you always see people saying, I was standing behind a guy who was buying lobster with food stamps. And, you know, I've been on this, you know, I've been buying groceries on my own for, you know, 30, 40 years now, and I've never seen anybody buy lobster, period, with food stamps or without. But yet you see some of these comment boards and you think that's all people are doing is buying lobster at grocery stores. And, you know, it's unfortunate. It's a misconception. And what we try to do is really educate folks. We have a lot of client stories on our website that show the real face of SNAP, and it's people that you wouldn't expect. It's neighbors, it's coworkers, it's church members, it's colleagues, it could be family members. They're, again, like I said, they cross all demographics, all parts of our society, from urban to suburban, and you'd be surprised who's dealing with hunger. I mean, it's not something that people like to really publicize if they have to, you know, get SNAP benefits. For a lot of people, it's embarrassing, but they need that help. And so to make it worse, to victimize them even more, it's really something that's atrocious.
Again, I'm speaking with Lucia Guerrero, the Vice President of Communications for Feeding America, the nation's leading hunger relief organization and the country's fourth largest charity. As the nation's leading domestic hunger relief charity, Feeding America helps supply food to more than 37 million people each year, including 14 million children and 3 million seniors, through a network of 203 member food banks that are supported by 61,000 local community agencies across the country. So you have this sort of gratuitous cruelty out there, the Fox News propaganda that food stamps are going to a bunch of freeloading surfers buying lobster. You have the Republican congressman from Tennessee whose family farm receives enormous crop subsidies, millions of dollars, yet he goes to the floor of the House and quotes the Bible saying, he who does not work should not be fed. Where does this myth come in to associate the needs, the real needs of our fellow citizens who are working but simply aren't being paid enough? I mean, that's what it comes down to. I mean, there are some protests being organized today on Thanksgiving and tomorrow, the so-called Black Friday, against Walmart for not paying its own workers enough, and its own workers are having to go to the food banks that have set up four charities, but end up having to feed their own workers. At least those in Ohio recently all apparently needed their own food bank, let alone one for charity.
Well, you know, we definitely see a lot of community support to make sure that people have enough to eat. And sometimes, like you said, we see poverty as a problem when it comes to food insecurity. And a lot of that poverty comes from not having a living wage and not being able to make ends meet, even when you do work really hard like they tell you to do and try to live the American dream, a lot of times that still isn't enough. Now, I'll be honest and tell you that Feeding America does work with a lot of corporate partners. We depend on our corporate partners to make sure that they help us get food to the community. So we try to, you know, educate folks, advocate on behalf of the hungry, and work with partners across the board, from corporations to individuals to the government, to make sure that people are fed. And that's our number one priority. I mean, we try to really make that our mission, is to make sure people are fed when they need food.
So, Lucia Guerrero, Give me a sense then, since you work with food banks across the country, give me a sense of who these people are. Who's going to be coming to the food banks? Are they going to be open on Thanksgiving Day?
A lot of them are having the distribution. Thanksgiving Day, some of them do it. They've had theirs the days before Thanksgiving. Will they be distributing throughout the week? And then on Thanksgiving, they'll have some distributions, and then Friday starts all over. And look, Ian, the problem is this goes on year-round. So our food banks are distributing food all year. What happens is people start to become aware of the need during the holidays, Christmas time. People think, oh, I should help out my fellow man. Unfortunately, we find that awareness drops off come January, February, once the good deeds have worn off and everybody goes back to their business. But guess what? The hungry are still out there, and Feeding America is still out there feeding folks. So we hope that people realize this is a year-round commitment. This is a year-round issue. It's not something that we can just shine a light on during the holidays and then hope it goes away.
But have you noticed an uptick in people showing up at food banks since the recent cuts to food stamps?
Yeah, we've definitely seen, especially with our senior population. I mean, these are folks who have a fixed income. They don't have no other way to make up for any loss that they may get with any reductions in food stamps. And so we haven't seen an uptick on that. This is the first month. We're starting to quantify that now with dollars. But I think we're going to see some real impact. And like we talked about, I mean, this is the first of potentially another cut that's coming up as Congress debates the Farm Bill, whereas you have the House that wants to cut another $30 billion out of the Farm Bill. And that's, you know, that's, again, food to people's tables that we're talking about. It's meals. It's not just a line item somewhere on someone's budget. These are real meals for people. These are, you know, staples that they're not going to be getting.
So what are these real meals that you get from food banks? I mean, I don't imagine you're going to have what most people are eating today on Thanksgiving. You're not going to have turkey and trimmings and all of the side dishes. What kind of meals? I mean, I guess because you're food banks, you can't have too much fresh food, right? You have to have tinned stuff and dried stuff.
Believe it or not, we've changed a lot. I like to say this isn't, you know, your grandfather's food bank anymore. This has really changed, and we've become much better at getting nutritious food out to folks. We've gotten better at that whole supply chain. So, like you said, it's a food bank, so you have to know you can't hold fresh fruits and vegetables very long, so you have to distribute them. A lot of our food banks do something called a mobile pantry, where they go out into the community with almost like a food van and are able to distribute food as soon as they get it. I mean, the goal is to have it sit very short time at a food bank. But during the holidays, you know, we try to make up with some kind of protein. If it's not turkey, we try to get folks, you know, canned hams or some other kind of protein. You know, we hear stories. I mean, you know how turkey legs are so popular at Renaissance fairs and things like that, the big turkey leg. Well, what happens with the rest of the turkey? That comes to us. So a lot of times we give out turkeys without legs, for example, to folks just to get them some protein, get them something they could put on the table for their family.
And recently I spoke with some people who do volunteer work in food banks here in Los Angeles, and they said that they get stuff from, as you mentioned, corporations. They also get stuff from restaurants, leftover. Right. They get stuff from caterers that are leftover. But one of the problems they have is that local communities or local residents don't like the idea of food banks in their neighborhood. It's that NIMBY factor. Have you run into that?
Yeah, sure. I think you always see that where folks maybe don't want the line of, you know, people who they don't want in their neighborhood perhaps lining up outside near their homes. But, you know, we find, again, because that face of hunger is changing, you'd be surprised at who's in that line now. It's not the people that you would expect to see in a food bank line. It's not the guy disheveled with torn clothes. It's family members who pull up in the station wagon and just, you know, are looking for some help to get some food on the table. So we do come across that. We have, you know, 61,000 agencies, and that means those are the soup kitchens, those are the pantries in church basements, in, you know, shelters throughout our communities. And so we try to do that in a dignified way so that our folks, our clients that do come see us, we still maintain their dignity and respect, because, you know, it's already hard enough to come into a food bank for a lot of folks, and we want to make sure that it's not a bad experience for them. And, you know, while they're there, and we also try to educate them on federal programs that may be available to them and other ways to help them in their situation.
So I take it there are, from what I understood from the people that I spoke with recently at a Hunger Action Los Angeles event, they were telling me that they're having trouble with some of the neighbors and having to move around a lot. And that's difficult because your clients don't know where you're going to show up, you know. But how receptive are these corporations? You say you deal with a lot of corporations. These organizations that I spoke with recently, they go to restaurants to get the food that was left over every evening, I guess, and to caterers. Sometimes there's a lot of food left over from big events. Give us a sense of where the resources come from. And when you say you work with corporations, what kind of food do you get from them? And what's the rationale for them having this surplus? Yeah.
So it's across the board for us. We're fortunate enough to be working with a lot of different industries. So that can be everything from, like we mentioned, the Walmart of the world and other grocers who are able to give us supplies right off their shelves, either things that are near expiration date or maybe, you know, may not look as presentable to most customers but are perfectly fine food. We deal with them. We deal a lot with the manufacturers themselves, ConAgra, General Mills, folks like that, where we can get it directly from them. And then we also deal, like you said, with restaurants who and caterers who sometimes have big events that they have food left over. And it's amazing how much food is wasted in this country, how much food goes to landfills that is still perfectly good food, either because, you know, a peach isn't the right size according to the USDA specifications or isn't, you know, as round as it needs to be, but is still a perfectly fine peach. A lot of times those peaches either go to a landfill or get chopped up for livestock feed, where we're able to rescue that food and bring it back to the food banks and then distribute it down to the community. So it goes across the board the way we get food. And, you know, it helps our corporations and our manufacturers not have so much waste, because we're able to take that and distribute that food, that good food, to communities. And then it helps us because we're able to get that food out there.
So I so often in restaurants you see people leaving enormous amounts of food on their plates, you know, those that don't want to take it home in a doggy bag, because there's nothing you can do about that. I guess there are health concerns, clearly.
Right. No, it's when they make big things for, like you said, like catering for a wedding or something like that, or for a large corporate event. That's the food that we'll rescue. We'll get the call. And again, we're trying to be as nimble as possible. We have to know we have to get that food and distribute as quick as possible, because especially that food that may come from a caterer doesn't have a long shelf life. So we know we have to move that as quickly as possible. And, you know, we've become experts at that. And again, these partner agencies, a lot of time our agencies will go directly and get the food and bring it back to their church pantries, their shelters and things like that, because they know they can distribute it quicker that way.
So given that your organization, Feeding America, feeds 37 million people each year, including 14 million children and 3 million seniors, through 203 member food banks supported by 61,000 local community agencies, who supports you? I mean, how, you know, you've got, that's an enormous amount of work there that you and these, yeah, your other fellow agencies are doing. Who supports you?
So we don't get any government funding, but we do get, obviously, donors donate to us. Our corporate donors help support us as well to get the mission out. And then locally, all of our food banks are independent 501c3s, so their own independent charity. In L.A., for example, it's the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank is our member food bank in Los Angeles. And they're mostly supported, again, by donors and by the community, because, you know, people know that it's important that to make sure that everybody has something to eat and to have enough to eat, especially their neighbors. And so we find that support at a local level is strong. We find that people want to make sure that people in their communities have enough to eat. So our local food banks really do a nice job of garnering that local support, whereas on the national level, we're able to get that national support and support us as a national organization and also help our local food banks do the work they need to do.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Lucio Guerrero, on this Thanksgiving Day.
All right. Thank you, Ian, and happy Thanksgiving.
And happy Thanksgiving to you. Again, I've been speaking with Lucia Guerrero, the Vice President of Communications for Feeding America, the nation's leading hunger relief organization and the country's fourth largest charity. As the nation's leading domestic hunger relief charity, Feeding America helps supply food to more than 37 million people each year, including 14 million children and 3 million seniors through a network of 203 member food banks that are supported by 61,000 local community agencies across the country. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about how the corn that the Native Americans gave to the pilgrims on that first Thanksgiving is distorting American agriculture.
Poor boy, head against a pillow, fast asleep. Poor girl, head against a window, lost in dream. But one day they will be as giant, stronger than the sun. But that day ain't yet come.
Turkey for me, turkey for you. Let's eat the turkey in my big brown shoe. Love to eat the turkey at the table. I once saw a movie with Betty Grable. Eat that turkey all night long. 50 million Elvis fans can't be wrong. Turkey lurkey do and turkey lurkey dap. I eat.
And joining us now is Josh Sewell, who is a senior policy analyst at Taxpayers for Common Sense. Welcome to Background Briefing, Josh Sewell.
All right. Thank you for having me.
And your organization, of course, it tries to make sense of the farm bill. And we've just recently had done a lot of coverage on the Republican Congress cutting food stamps out of the so-called SNAP program. And, of course, it's been revealed in a number of media outlets that while they're cutting back on food for poor people, we find out that many corporations and wealthy individuals are being subsidized enormously through the farm bill, and including Congressman Stephen Fincher of Tennessee, who took to the House floor and castigated the poor for not working. At the same time, he's a huge recipient of taxpayer money under the farm bill with these crop subsidies and these crop insurance subsidies. So how are you doing in terms of bringing common sense to this rather outrageous policy?
Well, I think we're making great progress. One of the issues that we're having right now is that in this farm bill, you have an economy right now, a farm economy that's doing great. And it's actually had some of the best years in the history of farming have happened in the last couple of years. And in fact, in 2012, you had record profits in the agriculture sector. And at the same time, we're facing near record deficits for a number of years at those same times they were experiencing their great years. And here we are now facing more than $600 billion deficit. We have $17 trillion in debt. And so the solution, the contribution that the ag sector, that the ag committees are willing to do is they're actually going to increase spending on corporate farming. They're going to increase spending on ag welfare while at the same time everybody else is being subject to sequestration.
So why is welfare for the wealthy and big corporations and agribusiness okay and not welfare for the poor and the hungry?
Well, that's a great question. I think one of the reasons is the agriculture sector has a lot of lobbying power here in Washington. There are only a few dozen districts that have significant agriculture in them, and those members of Congress are fighting tooth and nail to keep every dollar that they can flowing into their districts. It's a very hypocritical thing, but money talks here, and you can see it in the priorities for some of these members for what they're fighting for.
And it seems that corn is at the heart of this situation here. I mean, here we are talking on Thanksgiving, and the myth or the mythology of Thanksgiving is that the Native Americans actually saved the colonists who weren't the best farmers in a hostile and foreign land, and they gave them corn. I believe they had turkeys.
Right.
Maybe they gave them a turkey as well, but corn was the operative thing, right, that saved the colony and which became
right.
The United States. So is that the explanation for so much corn subsidies?
Well, part of it is one of the reasons we subsidize agriculture so much is because it's the oldest industry. And basically every country, it's the oldest industry for every country. And so there's this mythical notion that we have to have agriculture in order to have a that we have to support agriculture in order to have a good functioning society. And we've had such a federal intervention in agriculture for so long that it's a hard thing to shake. And interestingly, that there is, especially with corn, corn is the largest cash crop that we have in this country. It's by far the number one crop grown in this country. There's more acreage for corn than anything else. There's more money going through corn than anything else. So there are more farmers. There are more farmers who are growing corn than anything else. And so it's the biggest interest group when it comes to special interests in farming. Now, the idea that it's interesting that you bring up the pilgrims saving the Indians or the Indians saving the pilgrims with corn. The kind of corn we're growing now never would have been seen by anyone who founded this country. The bulk of the corn we have now is not grown for human consumption. Almost 40% of it is grown to put in our cars in ethanol. And then the bulk of the rest is grown to feed cows and pigs and other livestock. So very little of the corn that's grown in this country is actually directly consumed by people. It's called feed grain. So we're feeding it to pigs and our cars.
Again, I'm speaking with Josh Sewell, who's a senior policy analyst at Taxpayers for Common Sense, and we're talking about agriculture policy in this country and also the enormous farm subsidies, generous farm subsidies that are meted out that are arguably a form of right-wing welfare. At the same time, traditional welfare for people who need it is being cut. And my understanding is that the largest amount of farm subsidies in the United States, $85 billion in less than 20 years, has gone to the corn growth in this country, which takes up 60% of the crop insurance premiums that come out of taxpayer pockets, I might add.
Right, that's correct. Yeah, again, corn is by far the largest cash crop we have in this country. And when you're looking at the supports that we give federally to crops, about 80% of all subsidies, whether it's under crop insurance or other programs that send checks directly, go to just five major crops, and corn is the biggest of those, the others being cotton, rice, soybeans, and wheat. And so the bulk of the food that's actually on your supermarket shelves or that you're consuming wherever you get it receives little in comparison to those big commodities. Sometimes it receives nothing. And so it's a very interesting dynamic that you have here where you have the agriculture committees saying that we have to send billions of dollars every year or else we're not going to have food to put on our tables, when in reality, I don't know anybody who's ever eaten cotton. And again, most of the crops that we grow as far as corn and soybeans is actually going to feed, you know, indirectly, yes, by if you're feeding it to cattle and other livestock. But almost half of it now is going to feed our cars, which is just something that just doesn't make sense anymore.
So, Josh Sewell, you just were mentioning earlier that the corn that the Native Americans gave to the pilgrims to save them, in effect, through that first winter, that was healthy food, but it bears no resemblance to the corn that we have today. You mentioned how much of it goes into cars through ethanol. I also understand that in food processing, and which is in many ways the source of obesity in this country, that the ubiquitous ingredient that sweetens so much of our food and it's causing diabetes and obesity is called high fructose corn syrup. So how much is that a part of this mix?
Well, high fructose corn syrup is definitely a byproduct of our subsidization of corn production in this country. Basically, what we've done since the 1970s is we've had an express goal of maximizing the amount of, they call them commodities. They don't even refer to it as food anymore when you're talking about commodities of corn. And we have to find something to do with it. And so one thing that we've done is we created the renewable fuel standards, which requires significant amounts of ethanol to be blended into our gasoline. And then the high fructose corn syrup was developed as a way to dump excess corn into products to replace sugar. And so it's certainly been a contributing factor. And one of the solutions, it's amazing what you have happen here in Washington is when you have a problem that's either created or at least exacerbated by government policy, oftentimes the solution is, well, let's create up another government policy or another government program to mitigate for that. Well, one of the solutions in agriculture is just let's step back and stop meddling so much. If you are concerned about free markets, or if you're concerned about obesity, or if you're concerned about having a more dynamic rural economy based on local foods, the best step forward is to just stop the federal intervention from Washington. Stop picking winners and losers between crops and regions and say, let's let the market work its magic, frankly. And what we actually would think would happen is you would have a more dynamic, more robust agricultural sector if we stop picking certain crops over others and throwing money at them. And I think corn is a case in point for that.
But you were saying, Josh Sewell, that so much of America is covered in corn. It's grown ubiquitously. In fact, you can drive through several states and see nothing but corn. I've done that. And it's extraordinary how much of our farmland, how much of this prized arable land in this country is taken up growing the one crop, corn. And as you say, most of it's not edible for humans. Doesn't this have a very, very bad effect on soil itself? I mean, crop rotation, I understand, came in because farms were going fallow for growing the same crop year in and year out. So,
absolutely.
Is that what's happening here?
Yeah, corn is a very input-intensive crop, too, which means it takes a lot of fertilizer, it takes a lot of pesticides. And so what ends up happening is when you have the federal government and other government policies increasing the price of corn through these, whether it's through the renewable fuels mandate or it's through other policies that just promote corn at the expense of other things that could be grown, is you get farmers. It sends a market signal. It's one induced by the government that they should be planting corn everywhere they can, and we're seeing that there's no reason to rotate your crops if you can continue to get a lot of money for corn, and even if it fails because of crop insurance, you'll get your money back anyway. And at the same time, the massive run-up in corn prices that has been significantly influenced by government policy in the last few years has induced farmers to plant on marginal land. So we're talking the steepest land, the land that floods the most, some of the least fertile land, which is the most likely to fail and take the most amount of fertilizer, the most amount of pesticides. Farmers have an incentive to plant. Any time the government tells you we're gonna choose one crop over another, we're gonna get more money for growing one crop over another, it makes sense for a farmer who's out there to make money to start planning for the government instead of the market. And that's definitely what we're seeing, especially with corn.
Well, given the lack of diversity in our agriculture and how much the government subsidized this one crop that we're talking about here on Thanksgiving, because it was, after all, corn that the Native Americans gave to the Pilgrims for their first Thanksgiving meal, this is how ubiquitous corn is in our food and our produce. You've got cornmeal, corn syrup, cornstarch. Then you've got maltodextrin, magnesium citrate, potassium citrate, caramel color, ascorbic acid, cellulose, ethanol, modified food starch, citric acid, hydrogenized vegetable protein, and high fructose corn syrup. That's just some of them. The byproducts. And then, of course, it goes not only into your gas tank, it goes into cosmetics, medications, vitamins, plastics, diapers, even matches and batteries. So they're finding all kinds of way to use this stuff, but it all feels like it all comes from the same source, which is this sort of dumb autopilot, zombie-like policies that we have.
No, it is. And a lot of those products are developed from taxpayer-paid research, which is also an important thing. So we create, through our policies, we create a glut of corn, and then through more spending, we end up paying for ways to find out how ways to just use that excess corn. It's interesting that you mentioned, the Pilgrims and the Indians. What we tend to forget is that there were three things. It wasn't just corn. It was corn, squash, and beans. And so... It was a more a robust founding agriculture than it was just corn as the center. And I think that's an important lesson for going into the future, is that we can't put all our eggs in one basket, and having one crop that's going to be the foundation for our rural economies and for our supposed energy independence is just, it's a bad idea. It's not going to work. And so we've seen that the price is too high. The price that we're spending subsidizing these crops is too high. And the potential ramifications economically and environmentally and for the rural economy is just too high. So it's time to step back and let the market work a little better, and the way to do that is to have the government not mandate what should be planted. Let's actually just pull back. We can keep a robust safety net. We can keep one that will actually help farmers when they're facing a crisis. But what we have now is we're not talking about crises in farmer country. They're experiencing record or near-record profitability. What we're talking about is locking in record prices and covering them for shallow losses. I mean, that's what the debate is around now. It's centering the farm bill is not moving forward right now in Congress for three main reasons. One, they're fighting over nutrition programs, which make up 80% of the farm bill. And those aren't about plantings. That's about a nutrition safety net. Shouldn't be a conversation in the farm bill. That should be a completely separate conversation. And the other two things are southern farmers, basically rice and peanuts, want guaranteed prices that exceed what they're getting in the market. So they want the government to come in and guarantee prices. And that's a bone of contention. And then the other issue is that crop insurance, which is a gold-plated program, we cover on average 60% of the premiums, the cost of premiums for farmers to buy insurance that guarantees them revenue. Not that they have crops, that they get a certain amount of revenue. But that gold-plated program isn't good enough. So the farm lobby is pushing for what they call themselves a shallow loss program, which means the small losses will be covered by taxpayers. As little as 10% dip in your expected revenue, and taxpayers will write in and send checks. So what that means is they're fighting over not a safety net that's going to keep them from bankruptcy, but a safety net that's going to guarantee them profits. And that's just something that we absolutely can't afford right now.
Well, I wonder whether we can afford to, given the ubiquitous nature of it, we can afford to boycott corn. But it certainly sounds like we should, at least on Thanksgiving, be cautious about, not that most of the corn that's available now is inedible, but nevertheless, it is ubiquitous. And I think it's an important thing to point out on Thanksgiving, the irony of where we've come over these hundreds of years.
Absolutely.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it, Josh Sewell.
Right, I appreciate the opportunity.
Again, I've been speaking with Josh Sewell, who is the Senior Policy Analyst at Taxpayers for Common Sense in Washington, D.C. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was